So much has changed during the pandemic. For many, work is remote. Kids are Zooming to school, and family FaceTiming grandma now. Now, many of these changes will stick even after a vaccine. And Harvard Business School's Deborah Spahr says that that's not surprising. She argues that how we live, love, and work has always been driven by our technological advancements. Her new book is Work, Mate, Marry, Love: How Machines Shape Our Human Destiny. She'll be participating in a Boston Book Festival event, of which WBUR is a media partner. Professor Deborah Spahr, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm glad to have you. I am a fan of a good brain bending, and your book definitely, it bent my brain. I have never been confronted with the idea that our relationships, gender norms, concept of work is and who does it, all of it driven first and foremost by technology. Can you explain that idea?
Sure. So I should first say I wrote this book way before COVID hit, but I think COVID is bringing the argument into very sharp relief, because what I'm suggesting here is that all of our most intimate relationships, how we get married, how we have children, how we fall in love, all of those things at a deep level are being driven by technological shifts. And what I mean by that is that we all live in a particular moment in time. And the moment that we're living through is itself the product of certain technologies. And as those technologies change, our social structures change accordingly. If you look at how we live today and compare it to how we lived as human beings during the Industrial Revolution or way back in time, you can see that we live in fundamentally different ways because of the technologies that surround us.
So let's anchor people in the full breadth of what you mean by technology. You actually start all the way back with the plow, which actually surprised me. I think I was expecting fire, although you explain why you didn't start with fire in the book. How could something like the plow be more formative in our cultural practices around, again, gender roles, love, procreation, property, than say what we believed about the gods at that time, or about our bodies, or about whether the planets revolved around the sun or the sun around the planets?
Well, all of these things are important, of course, but the plow is particularly crucial. And I love telling the story of the plow because it's so obscure and people don't know it. But if you look across the really broad sweep of human history, for most of our time on this planet, we were hunters and gatherers. We didn't have private property. We found our food. And then over thousands of years, technologies began to change. And crucially, our ancestors developed plows and other technologies that enabled them to grow food rather than finding it. This was humankind's first great technological revolution. And once you shift to farming, kind of everything else changes. We won't have time to get into it now, but even the gods change, and how people thought about the gods changed when you start to grow food. And one of the first things that happens, of course, is you need private property. When you're growing food, you need private property. You need to own your seeds. You need to own your land. And crucially, you need children. So children become valuable, not just because one is emotionally attached to them, but because you need the labor. And crucially, you need children to inherit the land once you die. And so if you take the argument one step further, for the first time in history, men need to know who their children are. And the only way for a man in 8,000 BC to know who his children are is for that man to have sex with a certified virgin and to ensure that she never has sex with anybody else for the rest of her life. And that, without much romance, I'm afraid, is the history of marriage. And it's an institution that arose in a particular moment of time to solve a particular set of problems.
So there's 800 things that, of course, that evokes everything from the idea of a certified virgin to, wait, how can you know for sure, right? Which begat which, but the chain of events you just laid out is pretty convincing. So I want to jump forward. Farming lasted a long time, but eventually we get to the Industrial Revolution, which you focus on substantially as well. And I often ask this question, how big a deal is it? How big of a deal was the Industrial Revolution in rewriting humanity?
It was huge. I mean, if you look again in this very broad sweep of time, there have been three major technological revolutions: the agricultural, the industrial, and the one we're living through right now. But the Industrial Revolution, one of the things I find most intriguing about it is it created the whole idea of a future, which is hard for us to get our minds around. But prior to the Industrial Revolution, people didn't even think of the future, really, because their lives were going to unfold more or less the way their parents and grandparents had. They were going to live in the same village, farm the same land, live the same way. The Industrial Revolution creates the whole idea of change. And you can think of it because it wasn't even all that long ago. You're living in this teeny tiny little village and, you know, railroads come to the village. And in one generation, people saw that change. Even more important than railroads, of course, was factories. You didn't have factories before the Industrial Revolution. And what factories do, in addition to obvious things like creating cities and pollution, they create a labor force, a wage labor force. And so, for reasons I won't go into now, eventually it happened that the bulk of the wage labor force was men. So men became the paid wage earners and women became those who stayed home. So gender relationships and family structures change as a direct result of these railroads and factories that came out of the Industrial Revolution.
So let's stay right there for a minute, because that gives me a way to ask another question I wanted to ask you. You just talked about the change in gender roles. Men earn wages, women stay home. I said before, I enjoy a good brain bending, but that doesn't mean that in getting my brain bent, I don't get uncomfortable or find something troubling. And parts of this book were both for me. You talk about forward progress, and forward in my mind as a word has a moral dimension to it. But that example you just gave, some would not experience as morally forward. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
How do you grapple with that?
Well, I think we would all like to believe that the narrative arc of history moves in a moral direction. But I'm not sure it always does, or it certainly doesn't do that of its own volition. I mean, machines don't have a morality. Technology doesn't necessarily have a morality. It's up to us as humans to put the rules in place, to impose our morality on the machines that we create. I think if you take my argument and believe it to be even partially true, then it suggests that those of us who are living through the digital revolution have a moral obligation to try to bend this arc of history in a moral direction. And just to give one of, you know, a million different examples, you know, if we had cyberspace to do over again, we probably should have put some rules around it back in the 1990s. We probably should have thought about who owns data and what rules of privacy and what 6-year-olds can see online is something that we might have wanted to put rules around rather than just leaving to the market and the technology to find their way. If we look at what's happening right now with all of us working on Zoom, as you mentioned at the outset, we know right now that women are being disproportionately affected. Women are dropping out of the workforce. So yes, technology is causing that, but we have the ability to reshape how we respond to the technology. So my book is, you know, at a sort of a deep level, two-pronged, that I'm saying technology determines lots and lots of things, but we, the humans, still control the technology. So if you can understand where technology is heading, that's when you can start to put some moral guidelines and some legal guidelines around it.
So that gets to another argument I was kind of having with you in my head while I was reading the book, which is that, now, obviously, you've studied history in a way that never in my entire life will I. So with my limited knowledge, it seems to me that often we have a contractive response to technological advancements as well. So one might argue that nationalism is a response to globalization, for example, that when we push people fast to change socially and culturally, we actually seek to contract, to go backward. And where does that fit in this landscape? And how do we think about that right now and today? I mean, everything right now happens against the backdrop of a general election that is certainly culturally disruptive this year.
Yeah. So that's a great set of questions. I think you've read more history than you want to acknowledge. But for sure, you're exactly right. We as human beings are actually quite conservative, that we think we want change. We want change in the abstract. But then when we realize that change is actually going to affect us personally, we recoil from it. And I think it clearly there's a million different things going on right now, but this is a big part of what's going on right now politically, that we are going through, we societally, every one of us is going through a massive technological change, and it's affecting us in ways that are unsettling and are disturbing and are scary. And so at a deep subconscious level, it's not surprising that a lot of people are retreating to nativism, tribalism, conservatism, to bringing back the old ways of life. There's different words put around that. But we are seeing what, you know, in a flippant way, you could call a Luddite reaction. The argument I would like to make, at least, is to sort of underscore that this is a Luddite reaction. And I don't mean that in the flippant way. I mean it in the way that it is a response to technology. So some of the things that are sort of out there and painted as a response to immigration, a response to feminism, a response to transgender rights, I think at their core are reactions to technological change. And it's scary. And so we retreat into the past rather than figure out how best to embrace and shape the future that's going to come whether we want it or not.
Is there something fundamentally different about AI and algorithms than anything we've seen in technological history, in its ability to bake things into our cultural practices and our lives that we might not be able to undo or change or guide?
Well, I do think there's something fundamentally different about AI. You know, I don't think it's categorically different, but it's a major step change. And I would argue a little bit with the second half of your question, because I think many technologies have reshaped our culture. And, you know, going back to our early conversation, the plow created sort of culture as we know it. The Industrial Revolution created urban culture and work culture. So AI and machine learning and all of those things will continue that trajectory of reshaping culture. But what's different about this one, and the reason why I think this one does sort of stir up these deep fears in us, is that this is the first time in history when we're on the cusp of building machines that could be smarter than we are. And, you know, there's a reason why science fiction is full of examples of robots and AI, because that is, at some level, the final frontier. It's no longer that we're reshaping just human culture. We may be reshaping humanity. And that's scary. I mean, it's exhilarating and fascinating, but it's also fundamentally scary.
All right. And our last little bit, my last question, somewhere in the book, you talk about the fact that it's dangerous to peer too closely into the future. And yet, you know, this book is a framework for us to think about, about where we're headed. So, you know, in 30 seconds, because I'm going to make it as hard for you as possible, where are we headed?
I think we're at an inflection point that we are approaching a period where the role of humans as producers is really going to be up for grabs. For all of our history, we've been scratching out an existence, feeding ourselves, clothing ourselves. We don't need our own labor to do that anymore. We have machines to do most of the things that have characterized our identity kind of forever. Keynes raised this question amazingly back in 1930. What will happen to humans when we don't need to work anymore? And we can answer that in a positive way. We can develop philosophies and cultural pursuits and write poetry, or we can stumble into the dystopian future. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen in the foreseeable future. And that's a decision or a path, a critical path in the road that we have to figure out how to take the right way.
Deborah Spar is a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, former president of Barnard College, and the author of a number of books, including her latest, Work, Mate, Marry, Love, How Machines Shape Our Human Destiny. She'll be participating in a Boston Book Festival talk next Wednesday, of which WBUR is a media partner. Deborah Spar, thanks for joining us today.
This is my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.